When I think of the 4th of July, I usually am thinking about it as we're driving back from the Lake of the Ozarks. So I usually think about traffic. I think about all of the states we still have to get to as we come back towards New Jersey. And I also think about Nathan's hot dog eating contest on Coney Island. Those things all pop into my head. But I also think of what America represents to the world, which is a new home and a refuge. A place to make your mark, a place to call home, a place where you can be safe. At least that's the promise. Unless we forget, like Israel soon forgot, this land is not our land. It was a land that was belonging to the Native Americans, which we took from them by force. And this thought alone ought to humble us, but I came across a story as told on PBS's The Moth on June 17th by a woman by the name of Dori Samandazi Bonner, entitled A New Home, that speaks beautifully to God's command given first to Israel in our Deuteronomy passage today, but a command that holds true for our nation as well. And she says, I grew up in Afghanistan during the Russian occupation, and as a child, I remember my dad being gone a lot, and the subject of my dad's whereabouts was a taboo subject in my household because my mom told us we were never to ask him about his whereabouts, so we never did. And sometimes I wondered if he cared about us. We grew up during the war between the Afghan resistance to the Soviet occupation in our country, and I remember growing up in Kabul during the war, which was very difficult because of this very distinct whistling sound that the missiles make right before they hit their targets. And we heard this whistling sound day and night, week in, week out, month in, month out, while I was growing up. In the meantime, there was a rumor about a regime change, which was devastating news for my dad, who was a high-ranking officer working for the current regime. And historically, new regimes in Afghanistan take over by violence, and they dismantle the old regime. And all my family wanted to do was to get out of the country, but we couldn't because the government had placed restrictions on all exiting visas. The government wanted everybody to stand by them, and so the only way out of the country was to go out on forged papers. And then in 1990, very early, we made a very daring escape in the middle of the night, my parents and my siblings. We migrated all the way over to the United States on forged papers. My father requested, when he arrived here, political asylum, which meant that he could stay, we could stay temporarily, while our case worked its way through the courts. And they gave us work permits, they gave us driver's license for my mom and my dad, social security cards to all of us that were working. And we all ended up moving out to California and getting settled in, and we started working. And for the next 5 years, our lives pretty well went like this. Our lives were so normal that the worst thing in my mind at the time was having to get my mother to agree to let me to stay out past my curfew. And I'm at my very first job at the men's warehouse, and my dad calls me, and I could hear by the excitement in his voice that there was something going on back home. And he tells me, you need to come home right away because there is a letter from immigration. And since I speak the best English in my family, my father wanted me to come home and to translate that letter for everybody. For those of you who have been lucky enough not to be familiar with the immigration system in this country, they don't send you regular updates like, hey, thinking about you all, we haven't forgotten you. So my family gathers around the dining room table and they are saying, come on, come on, come on, what's it say, what's it say, read it. And it says our court appointment has been moved up to the next week. And it says that we need to bring all of our legal documents, all of our family photos and things that are of importance to us. So we start jumping up and down thinking that this is the appointment that we have been waiting for, and the day of our appointment has finally arrived, and we drive down to downtown Los Angeles and we go into a big government building where we check in and we go through the security. We go upstairs and there's an immigration officer waiting for us at the top of the stairs, and he guides us into this room. And after a moment, the doors open wide into this room. And right away, I felt like we were in the wrong place. The people who were sitting there were visibly upset, some of them crying. But we went in anyway. and we sat down, and we wait for them to call our name. After a while, my dad asked me to go up and ask how long this appointment was going to take, because he was dressed in his uniform, and he needed to get back to work since he was not able to put in for much more time. So I go up and I ask the immigration officer, "Can you tell me how long this appointment might be? Because my dad needs to get back to work." And the officer says, "Your dad will be going back to work all right, just not in this country." And my heart just sank, just dropped. Going back, you see, is not an option because we are now considered traitors. And I sit down and I tell my dad what the security guard said. And my dad, as soon as he hears what I have to say, lost all the color in his face, went completely white to ashen gray. And he slumped down in his chair, clutching his chest in pain. And I ran down the hall and I find a phone and I call our attorney. I was extremely upset with our attorney because we had given her all of the money that we had saved when we had come over here, and all the money that we had saved while we were here by not eating a meal as a family every single day for 5 years. We deprived ourselves. And the only thing that we wanted was to be sure that we would have our attorney with us, and for her to be here was really, for her not to be here with us was really upsetting to me. So I call her on the phone, I call her office, and this girl answers the phone, and she sounds like she's about 18 years old. She sounds like she's my age at the time. And I have to convince her to put our attorney on the phone. I tell her, "It's an emergency, please put Jody on the phone." And as soon as I hear her voice on the other end of the phone, I just completely break down, and I tell her that something is really wrong with my dad and they won't let us get help for him. So she tells me just to sit still and she's going to see what she can do. And so we are sitting there and my dad continues to be in pain for another 30 to 45 minutes until this man walks in and says our last name, calls it out. And all four of us get up and we're following him, but we're not sure where we're following him to. And we end up going into this very small office, which only my dad and I could fit into, like a closet. And there's a guy working at the desk and he doesn't look up or acknowledge that we're even in the room. He just hands over his papers. And the paper said on our visa that it had been extended for 3 months so that we could go get my dad medical help. And the next 3 months were the worst time of my life because of the fear of deportation every day. And we dread seeing the mailman arrive at our house every day because we fear what the mail will bring each day. And none of us want to be the one that has to go out and check the mailbox. And my dad, he does something really bizarre. He completely moves out of the bedroom that he and my mom have occupied for these last 5 years, and he begins sleeping on the couch in the living room with a pair of clothes, shoes, and socks ready to go right next to him. And the blinds are drawn in the house both day and night. And anytime somebody comes to the door, my dad, he'll rush up to the window to look through the blinds to see who it is. And finally, at the end of 3 months, we go for our hearing before the immigration court with our attorney. And I notice that it was a different judge who was sitting there this time, and he was an older gentleman, and he looks really intense. But I remember the first time I saw him, I was so intimidated by him because he wouldn't smile at me. He wouldn't talk, and I was pretty intimidated as a young girl because I had to translate whatever conversation was going to happen between him and my family. And after a few words with our attorney, he gets right into it, and he starts asking my dad if he has a translator. And my dad says, "I will translate for him." And the judge tells me, "Whatever I say to you, you translate exactly what I say, nothing more, nothing less. And whatever your dad says, you tell me exactly what he says, nothing more, nothing less, and I agree." And the judge begins to question my dad in a really demeaning way. Like, "Do I understand correctly that you came to this country on forged papers?" And my dad says, "Well, yes," but then he goes on this long explanation. And then he cuts off my dad and he says, "I just want to hear a yes or a no. I don't care about an explanation. I just want to hear a yes or a no. Did you come here on forged papers? Nothing else." And the conversation goes on like this for a while, and it's not going well at all. And finally, he tells my dad, "You know, we here in the United States do not give citizenship to people that break the law. We can't, and I won't." And as soon as I translate this to my dad, I just put my head down in my hands, and I start praying with all my might. And when I open up my eyes, I see my dad rising out of his seat, unbuckling his pants and his belt. At which point I'm thinking he's completely losing his mind. I'm not sure what he's getting ready to do, but he lifts up his shirt on the right side, and in his native language, he looks at the judge and he says to the judge, "This is what the communists did to me." And he's pointing to a 45-inch knife scar. And then he pushes down his pants in the courtroom on the backside and turns around again. And he says, "This is what the communists did to me," pointing to 3 gunshot wounds in his backside. And then he takes off his shoes and takes off his socks and stands in front of the table in front of the judge and says, "This is what the communists did to me," pointing to his toes, which have no nails on the bed because they'd been pulled out with pliers. And I remember thinking, I can't believe what I'm hearing, because as I'm translating these hard things that my dad is saying in his native tongue, I'm hearing and learning about them for the very first time myself. And I now understand why we were never to ask our father where he had been when he was away from us for all those stretches of time. And now I know where he had been all that time. He had been in prison being tortured by the communists. And at that moment, I never felt more sorrow in my life. My dad continues to tell the judge, "It's easy for you to judge me, Your Honor. You sit up there in that seat and you wear this robe, but if you came on this side of the table where I stand, you will see that I did everything I did to save my children. I had no other choice, and you might deny me the right to come into this country, but I know that if you were standing on this side of the table, you would have done the same thing. And if you have to show the American public that you don't take it easy on us because of forged papers, I understand. But please send me back. I'll volunteer. Please let my wife and my children stay here. Please give my children a new home." And then he puts his head in his hands, and he just starts crying like a baby. And the judge leaves, doesn't say a word. We're on break, the bailiff tells us. And he comes back after an hour. We're all waiting, wondering what the heck's going on. And as soon as he enters the courtroom again, I notice that he doesn't have his robe on. And he goes up to his bench to grab something. And he starts walking back down towards us. And I'm pretty nervous because we're not sure why he's walking towards us. And his eyes never left my father's eyes. He walks right past me. He walks right behind me. And he stops right next to where my dad is behind that big table. My dad turns and looks up at him, and the judge says, "Mr. Samandazi, let me see your right hand." And my dad shows him his right hand. And the judge puts a stamp in my father's hand and says, "Mr. Samandazi, I would like for you to stamp your children's papers." And together, the judge and my father stamp our papers. And when we look down at the papers, it says, "Asylum granted." And then he turns the page to my parents' papers. And again, he and the judge take that stamp together. And they stamp the papers, and it says, "Asylum granted." And the judge puts his hand on my father's shoulder and says, "Welcome to America, Mr. Samandazi. This is now your new home." It took us 18 years from the day that we arrived here to be granted American citizenship. And on January 29th, 2009, as I stood there, I was sworn in as an American citizen, and I pledged allegiance to my new flag and my new country, to my new home, And it is through my children, my two-year-old son, and my unborn child that is still in my womb, that I will make sure that this gratitude that overflows my heart every single day will continue to live on long, long after I am gone in them. Then the Lord said, it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to give your fathers and your mothers, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, Leah, Rachel, to give you great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and you are satisfied. Then watch yourself, that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of Afghanistan, out of the lands of Africa, out of the lands of South America, out of the lands of Europe, out of the lands of every corner of this earth, who brought you out of slavery. Later, we're going to sing a great hymn at the end of this service by Woody Guthrie. It's one of my favorites. This land is your land, this land is my land. But I respectfully disagree with Woody Guthrie's lyric. This land is your land, this land is my land. Because this land is not your land, nor is this land my land. It is God's land. And we are entrusted to care for it until we can leave it a better place than we found it. That's the meaning and the purpose of this country. Amen.